Hey, everybody. Host Nora McInerney is back for season two of The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has a real conversation with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they took action to understand this disease. So jump into the conversation for season two, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, and learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine. Hey, everybody. If you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuckers Bryant. And that makes this a very congested episode of Stuff You Should Know, right?
Yeah, we were just reminiscing about the, what was it, '08? Or nine?
I don't remember.
Probably 09, when Josh was sick for like, I said he was sick for a season, and that's really not too far off.
Yeah, but Yumi recently pointed out that I wasn't sick at all last year, and I don't think I've ever not been sick for a year. So it has to do probably with taking better care of myself, not smoking.
Probably. I get the stomach thing. I don't usually get regular sick.
Yeah, you do get stomach pains.
It's like when once,
you
do, it's once
like,
a year, man.
It's not awful. Even like a bug. It's like a staph of infection or Ebola of the stomach or something horrible like that.
Yes, it is gross.
So are you willing to muddle through this one with me sounding like this?
I think people can forgive that. We needed to get this one out in time for the September 11th anniversary.
Yeah, the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. The attack, the plane that went down, Flight 93 in Pennsylvania.
Have you seen that movie?
Yeah. And then the attack on the Pentagon.
Yeah.
The 10th anniversary is going to be a big, sad, sullen occasion.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like the last couple of years, it's been, you know, it's September 11th, and this is a time to stop and reflect for a moment. But I think it's all going to come barreling back. On the 10th anniversary.
Yeah, and I think people have been anticipating that. And the opening of the memorial, which we're going to talk about, has a lot to do with that, obviously.
It does. It's going to officially be dedicated and opened on September 11th, 2011.
Pretty good timing.
Yeah, and then the museum, which we'll also talk about, will be open the following year, I think on September 11th, 2012.
Man, that thing sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm very excited about going to these.
Me too.
Maybe excited's not the right word.
No, I'm excited about
going. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, there's nothing. It doesn't mean you're flippant about it.
No.
I'm excited to see them as well.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay, good. Thanks.
I get excited every time I go to those things.
Yeah.
It's a good place for remembrance, Josh.
Yes, that's memorials make an excellent spot for remembrance.
Yes.
Let's talk about the spot where the memorial, the World Trade Center Memorial, which is what we're talking about, is going to be situated. The original spot where the World Trade Center complex was situated.
Yes.
Work started in the 60s and was completed in, I think, 1973 on the towers. I think work for the whole World Trade Center complex wasn't completed until 1990.
Yeah, 14 years.
14 years after the towers were completed. So it was like 1987?
Yeah, something. Yeah. That's about right.
But tell me about the spot, the World Trade Center spot. It was a very ambitious project.
It was, Josh. Seven buildings total, spanning 16 acres. It's a lot of room. And each tower itself, I think, had a footprint of an acre.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They had office space to the tune of about 50,000 total workers, and about 35,000 of those were split among 430 companies.
Yep.
In the buildings.
It was 10 million square feet of office space.
That's incredible.
It was. It was originally, speaking of ambition, I read an article called The Height of Ambition. It was a 2002 New York Times article. And it's required reading for anybody. It's really good. It's all about the construction.
Cool.
It's about the attacks. It's a really comprehensive, great article.
I'll have to check that out.
But they were saying, like, there was no way they were going to go any less than 10 million square feet. When they decided to, they're like, that's it. We're doing 10 million.
Wow.
And that's such an enormous amount of office space that other real estate developers in the city were like, that's going to, like, imbalance the market.
Yeah.
That's so much. It's going to flood this place all at once.
Yeah, I remember at the time, on September 11th, thinking that the death toll was going to be like 10, 20, 30,000 people. Because I knew how many people work there.
Right. And it would have been had the buildings not stayed up for an hour or so.
Right. Or had it been an hour or so later.
Right.
Once people were all in there.
Yeah, because you said there's about 50,000 people that worked at the World Trade Centers. And then there's another maybe 70,000, 40,000 to 70,000 people who commuted through because there was a subway station underneath.
Yeah,
there was
and
a the
mall.
PATH train station.
Yeah.
And a mall. And people coming to have lunch with, like, their husband or wife or whatever. So 70,000 additional people pass through that complex every day.
Indeed, Josh. If we're talking size, we've got a couple of stats. The North Tower, the original World Trade Center 1, although there's a new one, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
1,368 feet, and then 1,730 feet with its large antenna. And then the South Tower was about 6 feet shorter than the North Tower, which I thought found interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was wonder why they did that.
Maybe the bedrock was six feet lower or something. It has to be something like that. I don't think it was. I'm sure they got to the final measurement and were like, you have to be kidding me.
Right. Because they were both 110 stories. It's not like WCTC2 was shortchanged a floor.
Right.
Or a half floor.
Yeah.
288,100 metric tons.
Yeah.
And each one of them.
It's tough to find comparisons for this, but a Ford Explorer, each one weighed about equivalent to 172,000 Ford Explorers.
That's heavy.
That's a heavy building.
And that's a lot of weight, and we'll get to that weight and what happened to a lot of that weight coming up shortly, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
So one of the cool things that you found was, originally when they planned the towers, they didn't know what kind of sway that a person could take. Let's say if you're working on story 90, like this tower is swaying back and forth in the wind, what that would do to people.
Yeah. No one had ever, when they were built, the tallest structures in the world.
You can't just have office space up there that people are getting sick on because they're dizzy.
Right.
Because no one would rent it out.
But they didn't know that, maybe somebody could take 6 feet of sway on either side.
Right.
They had no idea. Maybe people can take, like, almost no sway. So they had a guy in Eugene, Oregon, who was a psychologist, basically purchased an office building, put parts of it up on jacks, and, like, test people. He had them come in for eye exams.
Right.
But was really testing them to see how much sway they could put up with, and found not much, like a couple of inches either way.
Yeah.
After a couple of minutes of that, the people start freaking out, get dizzy, get nauseated. So they're like, you have to do something because your building's going to sway a lot more than this.
That's right. And you can't have your tenants getting sick. So they built in shock absorbers that prevented the sway. So I think most people know by now, just from breakdown of what happened with the collapse, that it was an exoskeleton design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was connected with a core, steel core, connected it with a hat truss at the top.
Yeah, so you had columns going out on the outside where they normally would have been put inside.
Yeah.
So that opened up much more office space. So the columns were on the outside, and there's a steel core in the center, like you said, and it was connected by a hat truss that just fit over the top and connected everything to the center. So it just stabilized the whole thing.
That's right.
And it made it light but very strong.
Right. I think it was about 95% open air inside the building itself.
Yeah.
Which has a lot to do with why it collapsed.
Yep.
There was a police station. Port Authority in New Jersey, New York and New Jersey had a police desk.
Yep.
They had its own, they had their own zip code and 8 dedicated mail carriers.
Yeah, I'm sure it's still there. It has to be. It still has its own zip code, right? 10048.
Yeah, I looked that up, actually. I think they held on to that zip code and to assign, you know, the new World Trade Center complex that same zip code, if I'm not mistaken.
I would hope so.
This is a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
But, yeah, 8 postal carriers just for the WTC complex.
Wow.
Like, they worked within, you know, well, I guess it was 16 acres, but it's probably not as big as your usual beat in New York, I would say.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Or route.
No, I think they call it beats.
That's just cops, though, isn't it? No?
Cops and mail carriers.
Mail carriers, okay.
Chuck, also these, just to give another idea of scale, there were each of the towers themselves, just the towers, had 99 elevators each. Each one had almost 22,000 windows. And apparently, you could have built a sidewalk, a standard sidewalk, I take it, from New York to Washington, D.C., with just the concrete used in just the towers.
Wow.
So these were massive, colossal structures. Just the towers. The whole complex itself was colossal.
Yeah, yeah.
But just the towers are enough to, like, get the point across, you know?
Well, and all you ever really hear about still is usually the WTC 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But all of the buildings were eventually raised, the whole complex.
Right, right. And we should also say that, you know, everybody kind of came on board, but in the beginning there were very big detractors to the World Trade Center projects, including those real estate developers who were like, this is going to be a drain on the market. And one of the guys was named Lawrence Wien, who was an Empire State Building co-owner, right? And he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times that had a picture of one of the World Trade Center towers with a plane flying into it to basically suggest that this was a hazard to air traffic, right?
Right.
And it actually almost came true in 1981 when an Aerolíneas flight just narrowly missed the North Tower, but made off okay. It was safe.
That's right.
Yeah.
In 1993, however, there was the first attack on the World Trade Center. An Islamist extremist group detonated about 1,000 pounds of explosives in a rented truck underneath the World Trade Center and killed 6 people, injured thousands, and they are included, which I thought was a classy move, in the World Trade Center Memorial years later.
Yeah.
I never really considered that, but I thought it was a pretty nice thing to do.
That truck left half a football field sized crater. And it apparently rocked the whole building. Like, you think, well, 6 people died. It couldn't have been that big. It was a huge blast.
Oh, yeah.
It was just in the wrong place.
Right.
But they were trying to take the building down, you know?
Yeah, from below.
So that, within a few days or weeks after the February 1993 attack, things were back to business as usual. Governor Andrew Cuomo was the first to move back into the office building, right? And things were just, like I said, business as usual. Until the morning of September 11th, 2001 came.
Yes, Peter, it's Don Dealer down here. I'm 4 blocks north of the World Trade Center. The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed. The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off, when you see the old demolitions of these old buildings. It pulled it down on itself and it is not there anymore.
That should be it.
It has completely collapsed.
The whole side has collapsed?
The whole building has collapsed.
So that pretty much speaks for itself, I think.
Yeah. Where were you that morning?
I had just gotten back from New York, actually.
Yeah.
I was there for a vacation and a Radiohead concert and in New Jersey. Or actually, it was Liberty State Park. And flew home on September, like, the 7th or something.
Well.
So I was I was living in L.A., but I flew back to Atlanta and then got stuck in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah,
for a
I bet
while
you got stuck, didn't
because
you?
Because everything was grounded. So I was in my friend Big John's warehouse, and Big Country Boy, and he woke me up. Dude, get up here.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember
going
that,
on.
Too. It was like one of the towers has been hit, and you just, when I started watching CNN and figuring out what was going on,
right.
I was like, this is not an accident.
Yeah, I think both of us kind of came to that conclusion pretty quick, too.
Yeah.
So I hung out in his warehouse all day, and we watched it on TV, basically, and, you know, mourned.
Yeah. I have to say, like, it didn't sink in as hard then as it did when we were researching this for this podcast, man.
Yeah.
I was watching, just finding that clip we just played. I watched about like an hour of, you know, as it happened coverage, and it was just, it really drew me in and just depressed me like crazy. But like it got through to me finally after 10 years. Like it really hit me how huge this is.
Yeah. I plowed through a bunch of video this week too and last week, and it was, you know, because I hadn't researched it for a long time.
Yeah.
After probably since like 2003.
Right.
So there've been many years of not even really considering it much. And then all of a sudden it's all back on.
Right.
And coming up this September.
And I think this being older too, especially for me being an older, you know, 10 years older.
Yeah.
It's gotten through to me a lot more. Like,
yeah. God, how old were you? You were in your early 20s, mid 20s?
I was like 25.
God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Just a pup.
Yeah. 24, 25, something like that. Yeah.
A long time ago.
Just a little kid. So, Chuck, we mentioned how there could have been tens of thousands more people who could have died had the buildings not stayed up. And there were a couple of big questions after the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. Number one, why did they fall? They didn't have to fall. And number two, why didn't they just fall over immediately? And the answer to the second question is the design.
Yeah.
That exoskeleton connected to a central steel core by a hat truss could have kept that thing up indefinitely. But the reason they fell was a fatal flaw, right? Those steel columns that make up the exoskeleton tapered at the top because they had to support less weight, making the whole structure lighter, requiring less steel, right? So the planes, when they flew into the higher floors, they were flying into steel columns that were only as thin as like a quarter inch across.
Right.
So they just severed them.
Yeah.
The problem is the true fatal flaw was the heat from the fire, though.
Yeah, I read a big article yesterday on this about this physicist basically explained how they came down to sort of rebut the idiots who say that it was a controlled demolition by the U.S. government, and like steel can't get that hot and melt and blah, blah, blah. And he explained the difference between heat and temperature. And I wish I was smart enough to relay that now.
Yeah.
But I would just advise just Google, like, why did they collapse? And there's a really good article on that.
Right. So
it's one of the first hits.
For our purposes, we're going to take it on face value that the heat from the raging fires created a high enough temperature that the steel, the thin enough steel, melted, and the weight distribution throughout the exoskeleton was even further compromised.
Yeah.
Until these things started going from the connection to the hat truss was snapped.
Yeah.
And then that was that. There was no support any longer.
So these floors obviously could support the weight of the floors on top of them because they had been up since 1973.
Right.
They can support the static weight. When the floors start collapsing on one another, it becomes moving heavier weight, and it's created a domino effect, essentially.
Right. It just plowed right into the floors beneath and picked up more and more steam as it went. Apparently, the material from the highest floors, by the time they reached the ground, were traveling about 120 miles an hour.
Yeah. And that could have been even faster, according to that physicist. And he said the fact that they fell straight down was sensible and fortunate, because they could have swayed and toppled over, which, you know, 110 stories falling to the left or to the right is going to take out, do a lot more damage, obviously.
Well, the South Tower did do some damage. The North Tower came down almost completely in its footprint, and it just compacted itself into this dense acre-sized square of debris that went from street level 70 feet underground to the bedrock and just filled its own footprint. Almost completely. The other towers, 3 and 7, were completely trashed. Tower 6 was still intact, but it had a huge chunk of the North Tower against it.
Right. Wasn't that the one they had to take out for those reasons?
Yeah.
Like, otherwise it might have been okay?
That one they actually did demolish.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the whole site kind of just became a loss. I guess an estimated 300,000 tons of scrap metal were generated. Most of it sold to India and China.
Yeah.
And there was a big hubbub. I didn't know this. Did you hear about this when it happened?
Yeah.
The mafia diverted like 255 tons of scrap metal to its own junkyards for profit.
Yeah.
and got caught pretty quickly because the FBI was on that case. But after that, there were, I think, 100,000 truckloads of debris trucked out to the landfill in New Jersey, I believe. It's called Fresh Kill Landfill. Those all got police escorts after the FBI found out the mafia was diverting scrap metal.
Right, obviously.
Yeah.
That's a good move. The cleanup was very quick. I remember at the time thinking that it happened way quicker than I thought it would.
Well, yeah, they were like, this is going to take a year, maybe two, maybe three.
Exactly.
It took like 8 or 9 months.
Yes. It also came in under budget. They thought it was going to cost a couple of $1 billion. And that was clearly overinflated because it only cost $650 million to clean up, which is a lot of money, but nothing compared to $2 billion.
No.
A lot less.
Yeah.
They did get a little criticism because they thought they kind of hurried the cleanup a little too much, considering the potential toxic materials found at the site.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought, you know, maybe we should take our time here, study this a little more, see what we have to deal with before we start sending people down there.
Well, one group called it the worst toxic site in our history.
Did he mean nation's history?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
It could be nation, New York, world. I don't know. There is a lot of toxic stuff. For example, 200,000 pounds of lead.
Yeah.
Plus cadmium from the 50,000 PCs in the World Trade Center offices.
Yeah.
Right? Mercury from the fluorescent lights. There are apparently about 500,000 fluorescent tube lights that all have mercury in them to work. Have you heard of polycystic aromatic hydrocarbons?
I have not.
They're apparently, they cause laryngeal cancer, and a couple of other cancers, and they come from partially burned, fossil fuels.
Wow.
What else, Chuck?
Asbestos, lots of asbestos, benzene, dioxin from oil and fuel. So not the kind of stuff you want to be breathing in. And people found, you know, years afterward, were getting sick. A lot of the first responders getting sick and dying even.
Yeah, the bass player from TV on the Radio was a first responder, and he came down with cancer like in his late 30s or something and died.
That's right.
And within the last year.
Did I know that he was a first responder? As what? What was his, what kind of responder was he, do you know?
I don't remember, but he was a first responder to Ground Zero.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, host Nora McInerney is back for season 2 of The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has real conversations with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they take action to understand the disease.
That's right. Recognizing how a migraine attack can change the course of your day, she unpacks each guest's journey and how they talk to their doctors to find the treatment plans that are right for them.
Yep, along with headache specialist Dr. Christopher Ryan and other special guests, Nora speaks to these incredible people who've channeled their feelings of isolation in their chronic migraine journey into advocacy and art. Plus, there are also 8 episodes of their first season available for you to binge.
So jump into the conversation for season 2, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, as they learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine.
You know, true love is always being excited from the first moment you see one another. And every time after that, it's taking long walks together in the summer or gazing longingly into each other's eyes and watching their tail wag when they chase a squirrel in the yard.
Well, the Pedigree brand asked about believing in love at first sight, and honestly, the answer is yes. As everyone knows from listening to this show, we have pulled all of our dogs off the street that Emily and I have had over the years, either right off the street or through a local shelter and working with them, and they've all become valued family members, and we think they've appreciated it too.
Yeah, Chuck, there is a Pedigree loyalty survey that found that 90% of first-time dog owners report having a dog improved at least one of their relationships, and 80% of first-time dog owners are overwhelmingly more likely to have made at least one new connection as a result of getting a dog. And 95% of all dog owners say that the bond they have with their dogs is closer than they ever expected. not a big surprise.
That's true. We all know that adopting a dog can lead to a lifetime meaningful connection, and real love can exist between a pet and a pet parent.
You got that straight.
Pedigree is committed to helping more dogs find loving homes. Opening your home to a dog can help open your heart. And love at first sight is closer than you think because it's available at your local dog shelter.
Yeah, very important point. You can find love at first sight with the Pedigree Adoption Drive from June 7th to June 9th. And the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide.
That's right. So just visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive. to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
So they've there was a combined payout of $625 million to some of the first responders and cleanup workers after a lawsuit was filed.
And that was just they came to that settlement within the last like year or two, right?
Yeah,
they've been hammering that out forever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was the Zadroga bill, which is massive, $7.4 billion in compensation for everything from like economic impact to health. But there's a big, there's a big outcry because they didn't include cancer.
Yeah, they couldn't find a definite link. I mean, this is one of those where I say throw it in there.
Yeah.
Like cover everything.
Right.
Apparently that's not the case, though.
Well, no, but it's left open so that it can be amended to include cancer later.
Oh, really?
Like if somebody's like, here's your definitive study on it that shows the link. But apparently the link is enough for people who are engaged in like personal litigation. They've been generally successful in suing New York.
Okay, just not a class action kind of thing?
Well, just not the Zadroga bill.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no one died during the cleanup of the Ground Zero, which is pretty amazing considering what a dangerous place it was. You know, there were like huge voids that were covered up, you know, by things that, you know, big gaps and holes that you could easily fall into.
Yeah, like, you know, those tiger traps?
Yeah.
Where it's just kind of covered with a little bit of twigs or leaves?
Yeah.
There were like 70-foot drops that looked like they were
stable,
solid rubble or whatever. But yeah, there's a picture of a huge earth mover like sliding down with a guy in it. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, I'm really surprised no one died during that cleanup.
Yeah. 60 men died building the thing.
Wow, that was the 70s.
Yeah.
So that brings us, Josh, to 10 years later.
Yeah.
The 9/11 Memorial and Museum, which we both said we're excited to go see because it's a pretty amazing design. To me, they hit all the right notes. And a lot of people have complained about the actual building, the new World Trade Center 1, has been beaten up pretty badly in the press. A lot of people think they should have just mimicked the original Twin Towers, except maybe a little higher as like a show of our strength as Americans.
Right, with a giant bird on the top.
Yeah, exactly. With Donald Trump on top, right. Flicking the bird. But Trump was one of the ones, actually, who hates the new WTC-1. Mm-hmm. And it is...
Well, originally it was called the Freedom Tower, which could not smack of the Bush era more.
Yeah, they changed that.
That or World War II, when we started calling French fries Freedom Fries.
Right. Was that World War II?
Yeah.
And that came about again after this? Or
yeah,
something?
Yeah. And then also sauerkraut was called Liberty Cabbage. That's just crazy jingoistic, you know?
Wow, yeah. So, like I said, Trump is not a big fan of the design or the architect who designed WTC-1, the new one.
What's his name? Daniel Libeskind.
Is that him?
He's been much battered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of feel bad for the guy, you know? He's trying to do a good job, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It is going to be the tallest building in the U.S. after it's completed at a symbolic height of 776 feet. 1776, obviously.
Right.
For the, you know, USA. All the way.
How do you mean?
1776.
What?
It's a very important date in our history. And all the buildings are going to be done between 2012 and 2016. And WTC-1 is right now at the 80th floor, which is, they're close to done.
How many floors is it going to be, did you say?
I think, well, part of what people are complaining about is the top third of this building is just hollow space.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people complained about that. So I don't know how many actual floors. They may be pretty close then, huh, if they're at the 80th floor now.
Yeah.
And I think they've concreted up to the 72nd floor, glassed it up to the 53rd. So it's
and
coming
then,
along.
And then 7 World Trade Center was opened in 2006. So that's already there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But the one that's being dedicated, well, in a few days by the time this thing comes out, is the World Trade Center Memorial, right?
Yes.
There have been a couple of other memorials, like the Sphere, which is a Fritz Koenig sculpture that was just iconically associated with the World Trade Center. It was found in the rubble.
Yeah.
It basically dusted off and put in Battery Park with an eternal flame.
Yes.
And then there was Tribute in Lights, which are the two beams. Anybody who's ever seen Spike Lee's 25th Hour
yeah.
is familiar with those. And those are brought out every year.
That's really cool looking.
It is. Very cool. It's like 44. Each tower is made up of 44 xenon searchlights focused into a single column
yeah.
that just shoots right up into space.
I wonder if they're going to do that still.
Yeah, I wonder too.
They should do that every year.
I agree.
Just for that one day, you know?
Yeah.
I think it'd be cool.
But they, you know, to get a more permanent exhibit, a design competition was held in 2003 by the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, right?
Yes.
And it was international. So people from all over the world submitted designs, like a ton of them.
Yeah, 63 countries in total, 5,201 submissions.
Mm-hmm. And the guy who won for the memorial went to Tech.
That's right.
Georgia Tech.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was working as a New York City Housing Authority architect until he won. And then I imagine he's making a little bit more money now at Handel Architects mm-hmm. as a partner.
Yeah, his name's Michael Arad.
That's how to get a job, a partnership pretty quick in as an architect, I think.
Well, that's how to make your career. Look at, like, Maya Lin,
yeah.
who did the Vietnam Memorial, was the first thing she ever did as a student.
Oh, really?
At Yale, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, have you ever seen the documentary on her?
Uh-uh.
Very neat.
How'd she come up with the idea?
She talks all about it. Like, the first third of the documentary is about that and, like, what she went through.
Right.
Like, there's a big problem that she was Asian, you know.
Sure.
That kind of thing. But I don't remember. I don't remember if it just came to her or what, but she talks about it.
I mean, that was perfect in its simplicity.
Totally.
It is perfect.
Yeah. But it was very much taken the wrong way, as I think there's always a group of people who take a memorial the wrong way. Although, and I think Michael Arad's been criticized, but I don't think anybody's like, this is a smack in the face to the people who died. And
yeah, I think it sounds pretty amazing.
Tell them about it.
Well, the centerpiece, it's going to, the memorial itself, there's a museum underneath, underground, which we'll get to, but the memorial plaza is about 8 acres of what will be forest land mm-hmm. With the two original footprints of the World Trade Center towers are now intact as fountains, waterfalls.
Yeah, the world's largest waterfalls.
52,000 gallons of water, I think, per minute
yeah.
flow through these things.
And they're these huge, massive, almost acre-sized squares, like you said, that are just fill in the footprints yeah. of the World Trade Centers. And they're just amazing looking. We can't really describe them any better than that because they're that simple. But unless you see a rendering of them, or
yeah.
there's some really cool architectural animations of them too,
uh-huh.
they just take your breath away.
Yeah.
And the memorial that Arad designed is called Reflecting Absence. And the whole point is to just kind of show we're missing something here.
Yeah.
And we're always going to be missing something here.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was such a brilliant design. It was not some, I don't know, it just made sense. You know, why build something up when you can say so much more yeah. by creating these two big voids? And then the water flowing, it's all very symbolic, you know, the recirculating water and
yeah.
Living, you know, breathing life into the city, and the trees are, I think, sweet gums and oaks, white oaks.
Yeah, swamp white oaks. There's going to be like 400 of them on the plaza.
Yeah.
And the plaza was designed by Peter Walker and partners from Berkeley, in conjunction with Michael Arad. I think that was the submission where these two people jointly coming up with this plan.
And he was like, hey, I'm the landscape architect.
Right.
I need some help.
Yeah. Or vice versa, you know.
Yeah, maybe so.
But Peter Walker came up with this idea to use suspended paving systems to
uh-huh.
support the white oaks, because an urban tree, or a tree in an urban forest like this, they don't live that long.
Right.
But And the reason why is because the soil becomes too compacted. You have to have paving for people to walk around on.
Right.
So what they came up with was a suspended paving system, which uses like columns and beams, like a grid, to create this hollow space that will support pavement, but will also allow roots to go through.
Yeah.
So these trees, these swamp white oaks, should thrive and live like many, many decades longer than ones that, you know, are just planted wherever along the street.
That's right. And they could potentially get up to about 60 feet tall, kind of creating a canopied park. So that was one of the things they wanted, was a quiet place, sort of a retreat from the city where you feel like you're sort of insulated from the rest of the city.
Yeah.
And the noises of the city.
And the swamp white oaks also, Chuck, are going to be brought in from all over the area of New York, but also from places around where Flight 93 went down in Pennsylvania, yeah, and in the D.C. area. So yeah, you're going to have trees from other 9/11 impacted areas brought.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
I read an article on the family who's supplied the trees, basically, for the project.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And then also around the Reflecting Absence Memorial, they're going to have basically a bronze wall with the names of all nearly 3,000 victims of the 1993 and 2001 attacks on the,
yes,
World Trade Center cut into them.
Yeah, so you can do the little charcoal rubbings on paper if you want. They, mm-hmm, shine light through them at night.
Mm-hmm.
They're grouped together by either where they died or where they worked, or if there was a special request to group people like with friends of theirs that worked in the building, that they've done that too.
That's cool.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And then probably the most noticeable feature within this little urban forest is going to be a glass building that forms the atrium or the entryway to the Memorial Museum.
That's right.
And the most noticeable feature of that are going to be these two steel tridents, which made up the exterior, that exoskeleton.
Mm-hmm.
They apparently went up. And then at the 70 feet mark, the seventh story, they split into three, and then they supported steel beams that went all the way up to the top of the building, right? So those things were left standing, I think, on the North Tower. So they took those off to Kennedy with a bunch of other artifacts and kept them in a hangar, and now they've been returned to the site, and they built the atrium around these two things.
Yeah, they used a lot of pieces of the World Trade Center in the museum itself.
Yeah.
To partially just, you know, remind people, and then also to show scale of, you know, I think the tridents themselves are close to 100 feet tall.
Yeah, I think 90.
Yeah.
Because they branch at the 70-foot mark, and they go up to, like, the 90-foot mark. So, and then also, Chuck, the museum itself is largely underground.
Yeah.
And they're in the footprints of the World Trade Center towers and parts around them. But basically, the whole thing's set up to give you an underground view of how incredibly massive these buildings were.
Yeah.
By leaving, like, the concrete footings, any steel supports that they can, intact.
Yeah.
And then just all, and I guess, playing off the vastness of the space.
Yeah, that had to do with the museum and the design up top, too. It was, I think you can, in the museum down below, you can stand in between the two footprints still.
Yeah.
And they've created a lot of just open space, it seems like.
Right. But then there's also, like, at the corners of the footprints, there's maybe, like, some, I think there's an aluminum-clad volumes, is what
right.
they're called, to basically give this kind of ghost outline of the building, so to give you an even better idea of their scale. And all this is underground. Like we said, the plaza actually above serves as a green roof to the museum.
Yeah.
And you go through the atrium, and then you, to get to the museum itself underground, you go through, you go down a ramp. And that's very symbolic of the ramp that was used to clean out the Ground Zero site.
Right.
It was used during construction of the original towers. So it's kind of like throwing you back in time and during the construction and the cleanup. Which, you know, really marks the history of this site, those two things.
Yeah, there's a couple of other notable aspects to the museum that they're going to have are the survivor stairs, which if you Google that, I mean, they're pretty famous. They were one of the sets of stairs that, you know, it said hundreds, but I would imagine maybe even thousands of people used mm-hmm. to escape.
It was like one of the only ways out.
Yeah.
It was along World Trade Center 6, I think.
So in 2008, it was lowered down into the site again, for its, you know, final resting place there in the museum.
Right.
And the other big thing is the last column in the west chamber of the museum. It's going to house this. And it was returned to the site. You might remember the last column was where it was one of the last things standing, obviously, and that's where people decorated this column with memories of their loved ones and have you seen this person, that kind of thing.
Right. They're also going to have the slurry wall in there, which was surprisingly intact. It was an original huge wall that they built to keep the Hudson from flooding it.
Yeah.
And after the attacks, after the collapse of the building, this wall was just standing there. It didn't have any support, but it was still keeping the Hudson out. So they reinforced it and rebuilt it, but they took a 62 by 64 foot section of the slurry wall, and it's going to make up a significant part of the museum itself.
That's huge, man. This must be enormous under there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, beyond all these huge elements, they have all the void open space.
Yep.
So
I'm very much looking forward to going to that.
I think we skipped over the Memorial Glade in the park above the museum. There is a section called the Memorial Glade, which is going to be an open area where they'll have like ceremonies and things like that. And I think that's surrounded by sweet gums, which should be autumn red on September 11th.
Yeah,
is what they say.
Nice.
They plan it that way, at least.
The museum itself, like the exhibits that they're going to have, they're going to have permanent exhibits of artifacts from, you know, the cleanup, from the rescue, from the attacks.
Yeah.
Personal stories.
Pre-attack, too, I think they're going to have, obviously, I'm sure they're going to have some information on
sure, like the construction and all that.
Yeah, and then probably the people who did it. I imagine there'll be some information there.
Yeah, and also they're going to have some stuff on the D.C. and Pittsburgh losses, or not Pittsburgh, but Pennsylvania losses. But there's a very controversial exhibit that's going to be added. It looks like it's going to be added as far back as, or as recently as April. That's as far back as I can find any press.
I found something more recently. I think it is.
It's going to. They're going forward with it.
Yeah.
Well, there were a lot of human remains found.
Right.
And a lot of them were put together and said, you know, this is this person. This belonged to this person.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, like, the matches ran out. And the medical examiner still has over 9,000 pieces of human remains. And the last match was made in 2009. So they're kind of losing hope that they're ever going
right.
to be able to identify who they belong to.
Yeah, and a lot of people are unidentified at this point.
Well, a lot of the families of the 41% of the victims who haven't been identified are saying, keep trying. Don't stop.
Right.
Medical examiner and the people who are running the museum are saying, no, we have a better place for them. Why don't we put them in the museum?
Right.
And they have it planned to put them behind a quote from Virgil that says, no day shall erase you from the memory of time. And the letters themselves are going to be made of World Trade Center steel.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, a lot of people find this ghoulish and ghastly. Like, you can't put human remains on display. And in this article in the New York Times, they interviewed a lot of curators who are like, it depends, you know, like, you
right.
can't just put human remains in a museum. You're not supposed to do that. But if it's a memorial on the site of an atrocity, like Auschwitz has lots of human remains.
Right.
The Khmer Rouge Museum has all sorts of human remains. So this is, museum-wise speaking, appropriate. But really, I mean, it's up to your, you know, what you think is morally acceptable or not.
Yeah, I think, from what I read, most of the upset comes from the fact that they were underground in the museum, and they were supposedly told that they were going to be kept in a tomb
right.
in the park above ground.
Right, and away from tourists. Like,
yeah.
this plan is to put them right in the exhibit. Like, here's some of the remains of the victims.
Right. But there would be I guess there would be tourists up top as well, but
right.
I mean, I see their difference, though.
Yeah, no, there's a big difference for sure.
Yeah.
But I think just about everybody agrees they should be kept on the site somewhere. It's just in what capacity.
Right.
Chuck, let's say I have $100 sitting around and I'm like, I want to contribute to this memorial. What can I do?
You can buy a cobblestone.
I can.
I was a little disappointed to see that the cobblestones weren't engraved, because that's usually what you
really?
Do. Yeah. There's a website that links your cobblestone to your name. So it's not an actual engraved cobblestone.
Oh, well, huh.
But you can still donate $100. That'll get you a cobblestone on the path of the plaza itself. $500 will get you a cobblestone on the Memorial Glade mm-hmm. that we told you about, and $1,000 will get you one, a granite paver that will be a walkway to the memorial itself. And that is at 911memorial.org/donations. And I imagine you can just donate, period, if you want.
Sure, yeah.
Or, you know, you'll get your cobblestones, but if that's not important to you, then it's probably a good cause, I would say.
Yep. And if you're going to be in New York this September 11th, the September 11th Memorial will officially open that day. And if you're going to be in New York September 11th, 2012, the Memorial Museum is expected to be open then.
Yeah, there people like are shooting video of the waterfalls being tested and stuff out of their office window. And
yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of articles on the site. We have how the World Trade Center worked. Or I guess the World Trade Center is what it's called. And it's very comprehensive. I think Tom Harris wrote it, so you can type in World Trade Center. And that should also bring up how the World Trade Center Memorial works.
Yes, which is
article.
Coming soon, right?
It'll be up by the time this comes out. So,
yeah. I hope so.
And again, if you want to learn more about the memorial, you can go to 911memorial.org, and you can donate there, too. And is that it?
I think this is our 9/11 podcast. We've been asked by a bunch of people to do one, and unless we're inspired to actually go over the grisly details, I would say this will serve that purpose. You concur?
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to do that one.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Host Nora McInerney is back for season 2 of The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has real conversations with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they take action to understand the disease.
That's right. Recognizing how a migraine attack can change the course of your day, she unpacks each guest's journey and how they talk to their doctors to find the treatment plans that are right for them.
Yep, along with headache specialist Dr. Christopher Ryan and other special guests, Nora speaks to these incredible people who've channeled their feelings of isolation in their chronic migraine journey into advocacy and art. Plus, there are also 8 episodes of their first season available for you to binge.
So jump into the conversation for season 2, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, as they learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine.
You know, true love is always being excited from the first moment you see one another. And every time after that, it's taking long walks together in the summer, or gazing longingly into each other's eyes, and watching their tail wag when they chase a squirrel in the yard.
Well, the Pedigree brand asked about believing in love at first sight, and honestly, the answer is yes. As everyone knows from listening to this show, we have pulled all of our dogs off the street that Emily and I have had over the years, either right off the street or through a local shelter and working with them, and they've all become valued family members, and we think they've appreciated it too.
Yeah, Chuck, there is a Pedigree loyalty survey that found that 90% of first-time dog owners report having a dog improved at least one of their relationships, and 80% of first-time dog owners are overwhelmingly more likely to have made at least one new connection as a result of getting a dog. And 95% of all dog owners say that the bond they have with their dogs is closer than they ever expected. Not a big surprise.
That's true. We all know that adopting a dog can lead to a lifetime meaningful connection, and real love can exist between a pet and a pet parent.
You got that straight.
Pedigree is committed to helping more dogs find loving homes. Opening your home to a dog can help open your heart. And love at first sight is closer than you think because it's available at your local dog shelter.
Yeah, very important point. You can find love at first sight with the Pedigree Adoption Drive from June 7th to June 9th. And the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide.
That's right. So just visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
That's it.
All right.
You want to send us an email? We'd love to hear from you. Send it to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Hey, everybody. If you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions. Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.